Well, we got kind of a lot of balls in the air today. Exam Monday, help session. No help required.
Friday?
Friday's the good day. I think I don't have lab Friday. Yeah, I'm reasonably sure of that. So it could be at 4 or something like that. Could be any time Friday, aside from the 12:40 time period.
4 sounds good to me.
4-ish. Okay. So I never like doing genuinely new material the day before exams because I don't think it gets your full attention. So I'm often looking for things to do that certainly aren't going to be on the exam, and in some theoretical sense that presumably won't be actualized, you could ignore them. And so what I have in mind to do Friday is to do what's on this handout. So this is a product of David Merman, who's at Cornell. And interestingly enough, Dick Feynman liked it enough that he wrote a congratulatory letter to Merman. And the only reason I know that is that there's a nice video. So you can YouTube Merman's lecture, the Oppenheimer lecture at Berkeley, that deals with, approximately speaking, this exact same topic. He's changed how he deals with kind of the last chapter. There's even a better example than the example he used when he wrote this enlarged reference frame. And I don't know, I think my plan is just to let Merman talk. He's more amusing than I am. So I will probably just play that YouTube video on Friday. And the link is there, so if you want to come to class, I guess you could watch it at your leisure. You might actually have questions that you can ask me better if I'm here than if I'm not here. Merman doesn't respond to your questions on the YouTube channel. Although, interestingly enough, he does say he will answer email about it. Although, I think he said that in 2008. I'm not sure that he means that today. I think he's retired. But maybe he has nothing better to do than answer questions now. So, we're finishing up the chapter on time-dependent perturbation theory. And yeah, a lot of it is pretty standard, right? We've got a perfect Hamiltonian that has an additional term to it. We write out our exact solutions. The coefficients are going to depend on time because we're going to see transitions. And we work our way through, and to first approximation in our iterative solution, we get that result for the buildup of probability in the state B. Our plan is to apply this to sinusoidally varying perturbations. So this is a perfectly good equation for any circumstance, but sinusoidally applied perturbations are pretty common. So that's the one we're going to deal with. And we plug this in and we get this result. And the upshot is that transitions are likely pretty much only if x is equal to 0, if omega naught is equal to omega. That is to say, if the frequency that you put in is exactly the frequency difference between the two states that you're trying to make a transition between. In terms of light, we can interpret that in terms of photon energies. So the photon energy it takes to go from state A to state B is the difference in energy, and the difference in energy is just the difference in omegas times h bar. So if we put in a photon that has that energy, that is to say, if omega equals omega naught, then we're expecting transitions. Now, you don't have to have x exactly equal to zero. That is to say, this function has a width, but the width is proportional to 1 over time. And for light, we're talking about omega 10 to the 15th, and maybe, I don't know, choose your favorite macroscopic time. A whole lot of digits of omega and omega naught are going to have to agree if we're going to get this sort of transition to occur. Okay, so the particular case of light, we're going to have, of course, light has both an electric field and a magnetic field, and both can cause transitions. But it turns out that the magnetic dipole radiation is, for atoms, is small compared to the electric dipole emission. Turns out that the important parameter is kind of the wavelength divided by the radius of what you're talking about. So for visible light, the wavelengths are 1,000 times the size of the atom. And so electric dipole radiation is by far the most prominent. In nuclei, where the wavelengths are shorter and the objects are shorter, you get pretty frequently other sorts of types of light, not just electric dipole, E1 radiation, but lots of M1 radiation and E2 electric quadrupole radiation. They all are much more prominent in nuclei. And of course, you could do it in nuclei the same way, it's just we're kind of doing this quasi-historically. So people didn't understand nuclei until, I don't know, into the 50s, something like that. Okay, so we're going to be talking mostly then about electric dipole emission and absorption, which is usually labeled E1. And the word dipole comes from actually a couple of things, but if we just put in that the potential that we're going to have to make a constant electric field, say in the z direction, is going to have this form, the dipole element that we're going to need in order to calculate these transitions is going to be the charge times z, and that's exactly what the electric dipole was last semester. It also turns out if we were going to do the quantum field theory, quantize the electromagnetic field, the light that's given out has the spatial distribution, angular distribution that goes along with electric quadrupole emission that we talked about at the very end of last semester. Okay, so if we plug in this electric dipole, put it in this formula, add up the frequencies, we get this formula for the probability of going into some excited state. It's proportional to time, so we have a rate of absorption when we take the derivative of that, and that's great for calculating this problem of absorption, where, again, we don't really have photons, but boy, it's easy to interpret in terms of photons, where the photon comes in and the electron jumps up from the ground state A to some excited state B. To me, at least, a real kind of surprise is stimulated emission, which gives you exactly the same number for the problem that you have the electron in the excited state, and you shine light of a frequency that would be required to bring one from A to B, and it turns out it also brings things from B to A. It brings them back down. So we get energy transferred from the atom as the electron goes to a lower energy state to the electromagnetic field. We get amplification from stimulated emission. And really what we're after, something that's a measurable quantity, is the spontaneous emission rate. That is to say, if we just have an atom that's in an excited state, roughly how long is it going to take before it falls down? And in what we have, the time it takes to fall down is infinity. These things are stationary states. There's no reason for them to fall down. And what Einstein did all before the sort of theory we came up with is invented the idea of stimulated emission. As far as I know, the concept that if you shine in photons, it would force things to jump down, didn't exist when he wrote his paper. And he found a relationship between all of these guys. He showed before, I mean, we've shown it with first order perturbation theory, but he showed that these two rates had to be the same and related spontaneous emission to those two rates. And that's the direction we're trying to go, to get a formula for how long, for what the lifetime is of an excited state of, say, hydrogen. And his trick was to apply thermodynamics. So Einstein, I'm trying to remember what the other thing was. So Einstein kind of famously said that there are two things that he thought were going to be forever. And one of them was thermodynamics, because it is kind of just based on logic as opposed to a particular mechanics. Right? So Newtonian mechanics is dead, long live Einsteinian mechanics. But some things are, maybe it was geometrical optics. I can't remember what the other one was. But thermodynamics seems to be much more general than the sort of things that that occur in terms of electricity and magnetism or mechanics or any of those sorts of things. Nice general arguments that won't be fooled by new sorts of mechanics. So in any case, his idea was that if you put an atom in thermal radiation, it had to have some population distribution that's given by the Boltzmann factor, right? Like what we were doing last year in advanced lab, right? So the probability of being in this excited state depends on the energy gap between it and the ground state. And you can prove that under very general circumstances. And Planck had shown that the light, the thermal radiation, the light that's inside a box that has some temperature T, has this distribution of frequencies. So it's a random array of polarization and all possible frequencies with this particular distribution. And the units of this omega are energy per volume per delta omega bin, right? It's a distribution. Questions? Good to go? So the one thing we need to do before we apply Einstein's argument is to remember that all sorts of polarizations are going to be present in this light. We've worked this problem for a particular polarization, the electric field in the z direction. But the electric fields are going to be random for this thermal distribution. So given that we have some dipole P, and we have an electric field that's in a random direction, what's going to be the average value of this quantity? So we're going to seek the average value over all possible polarizations for this P vector. Okay, so the easy way to do it, and I guess I don't know why the book doesn't do it what I would call the easy way, is to put the P vector on the z-axis, and then this quantity that we're talking about is going to be proportional to cosine squared of theta. And so P squared is going to be P squared cosine theta, and we just want the average value of cosine squared over all possible orientations. Okay, so that's pretty easy to do. So we have the integral of cosine squared over d omega divided by the integral of d omega. That'll give us the average value of cosine squared. And what we need to modify our formula for that effect. Okay, well, easily done. So we've got cosine squared theta, sine theta, d theta, d phi, and we know that the total solid angle is 4 pi. We can do the phi integral, There's nothing that depends on phi, so as we go from 0 to 2 pi, we get 2 pi. So we've got the integral of cosine squared theta sine theta d theta divided by 2 now. Do the usual change of variables. Let's let c be sine theta. So what we have here is minus dc, and this would be for sine of 0, sine of 180, or the cosine, the sine of 180 degrees is minus 1. So we use this minus sign to switch around these integrals. So this is the integral from minus 1 to 1 of cosine squared d cosine, and we still have the 2 in the denominator. So this is easy antiderivative, c cubed over 3. And so we're going to get 1 third minus a minus 1 third over 2. So we get 1 third. Okay, so when we immerse this atom in these randomly polarized electric fields, instead of the electric field being just in a particular direction, we're going to end up with 1 third of this result. Okay, so the upshot then is this rate, the rate that A becomes B, is this formula. And so let me just use P AB to be this matrix element, this dipole matrix element squared. We only get a third of it. So that's the rate that we're going to get transitions, the rate of absorption, the rate at which we're going to get transmissions from A to B. And since the matrix element is the same, if we reverse the bra and the ket, it's also going to be the rate of stimulated emission. Okay, so, oops, I dropped my pi. So now we run Einstein's argument. We have our two levels, A and B. The rate of increase in the population in the B level is going to be what? Well, it's going to be decreasing at some rate that has to do with the spontaneous emission rate. Right? So this is like in nuclear, where you have dN dt is minus lambda n. Right? That's the 1 over the lifetime of the state. We're going to be pumping things in according to the number of particles we have in the lower state and the rate that we're going from A to B and the amount of energy, the energy density that we have present in order to cause that. And we're also going to have stimulated emission. So proportional to the number of atoms that are there and the rate that B goes to A, and again, the energy density that we've got in order to cause that result. In thermal equilibrium, this quantity should be unchanging, and the number of B divided by the number of A should be E to the minus the difference in energy divided by kT. And the difference in energy, so you remember that these omegas, when you multiply them by h-bar, are going to give you that difference in energy. This is e to the minus h-bar omega naught divided by kT. Okay, so plug and chug. It's going to be actually more convenient to take this equation and divide it by NB as opposed to dividing it by NA. All that does is flip around the sign, of course. So let's go do it. So we've got 0 is equal to minus A, this canceling out, plus NA over NB, the rate that A goes to B, the energy density, minus 1, the rate that B goes to A, times the energy density. Okay, so let's solve this for the energy density, because Planck gave us the formula for the energy density. So if we do that, put the A on that side of the equation, what we've got is the energy density in the light at that frequency omega is going to be equal to A divided by NA over NB times the rate that A goes to B minus the rate that B goes to A. Okay, so that's Einstein's result without using any of this quantum mechanics. It's pre-quantum mechanics. And at this point, what Einstein says is, Planck has told me what the answer is, right? So the answer is that one over there, h bar over pi squared c cubed. H bar not squared, pi squared c cubed. Omega cubed divided by e to the h bar omega divided by kt minus 1. Okay, and this guy here, this is e to the h bar omega divided by kt. So how can those two formulas be the same? Well, the only way we're going to get this minus 1 here is if these two guys are the same and they factor out. So he says it must be that the rate A goes to B has to equal the rate that B goes to A. And if we factor that guy out, we have A over that common rate has to be equal. So I factor that out, I plug this in. So this is e to the h bar omega divided by kt minus 1. And what I see then is that this a factor has to equal all of that. The spontaneous emission rate has to be the rate of either a going to b or b going to a times omega cubed divided by pi squared c cubed h bar. Okay, and to calculate that rate, quantum mechanics gives us this. Einstein didn't have that. He actually had good reasons to suspect lots of those same terms would be present. Well, so how many of you are in nuclear now? Nobody? Somebody? Nobody. Okay, so let's spend a second reminding you about basic sort of stuff from modern about decays. So what we have for any sort of decay process is usually this sort of formula. And that is easily integrated, right, to be that. Exponential decay. And not uncommonly, people talk about the half-life of a process. So for the half-life of a process, we have half as many as we had before. So we have that 1/2 is equal to the minus lambda t. Take the natural logarithm of both sides of this. So we get minus the natural logarithm of 2 is equal to minus lambda t. So the half-life, the time we're talking about, is equal to the natural log of t divided by lambda. And the natural log of 2 is 0.693, I think. Okay, so just 1 over lambda, that's something that has the units of inverse time. That's sometimes called the lifetime. In contrast to this 0.693 divided by lambda, that's the half-life. Okay, so I think it's fair to say that physicists like lifetime because there's not this kind of magic natural logarithm of two present. But it seems that half-life has more than half a life of its own. So you see that very commonly in text. And of course, what we have is this A term. So this A is exactly the decay constant lambda that we're talking about, except in this case applied to excited states. Well, for homework, you're going to actually be calculating some of these numbers, but what sort of values, roughly speaking, should we expect for these half-lives? So what we have is the lifetime as opposed to the half-life, that is to say 1 over a. It's going to be equal to pi squared c cubed divided by this rate h bar omega cubed. And here's our formula for the I think I lied a little bit. When I wrote down that equation, I did factor out this rho, right? So I said that the time rate of k, it's not much left of it. I said, for example, that we had a loss that was equal to the number of states in B times the rate that B became A times the energy density, right? So the thing that is R is everything except this rho naught. So we've got pi squared, c cubed. We've got the dipole squared. And we've got a pi. And we've got a h bar squared and an epsilon naught. Well, maybe I'll be happy to do A. Yeah, I'm going to do A instead. And then we can just take one over it to figure out what we've got. Just a matter of what I like to have where. So R is this P squared divided by H bar squared epsilon naught pi. And my plan is just to plug and chug through and get, you know, an estimate. Is this seconds? Is this milliseconds? What's kind of the characteristic time for these things to occur? So let me call this an estimate just slash a unit check to make sure that I've got something that's more or less right. Ooh, what happened to my 1/3? So this thing didn't have the 1/3 yet, right? When we averaged it, that's when we got the 1/3. Okay. So we've got some cancellations. What's an estimate for the value of the dipole moment? Well, again, we're not trying to make particularly accurate estimates. This is, in some extent, just a unit check. But the units that we have, the scale of an atom, is the Bohr radius. So, you know, roughly speaking, this should be the charge times a Bohr radius. And so now we have kind of a complicating feature. I bet you don't, and I know I don't, remember the formula for the Bohr radius. It's kind of an ugly formula. But I do remember the formula for the Compton radius of something. basically because it's more important than the Bohr radius. So the Compton radius of something is h bar divided by mc. And I hope you can see that the units are going to work out on this, because mc is a mass times a velocity, so it's a momentum. And the units of h-bar have to be momentum times position, right, because of the uncertainty relationship. So I am going to get something that has the units of length out of this. Whether I divide this by 2 pi or not, some people would put a bar through that because it's divided by 2 pi. And maybe I will just for fun. But in this process, I'm not caring about pi's and 2 pi's. I'm just trying to get a real ballpark estimate. So what is true is the Bohr radius is bigger than the Compton radius by a factor of 1 over alpha. So remember that alpha is the fine structure constant. It's dimensionless. That's its great, great claim to fame. It's 1 over 137. Okay, so what I've got here then is E times the Compton radius divided by alpha. E times the Compton radius divided by alpha squared. How about all of the, and I guess I can also say that alpha is equal to E squared divided by 4 pi epsilon h bar c. I think I can say that. And I don't know, what allows me to say that, I guess, is that h bar c, sometimes it's called the conversion constant. It's 197 MeV Fermis or EV nanometers. In any case, it has the units of energy times distance. So I can take the distance unit, and then I get E squared over 4 pi epsilon distance, and that's the formula for the electrical potential energy. So I then have energy over energy, so it's nice and unitless. Okay, so I can take this E squared, and I can take this epsilon naught, and, well, 3 isn't 4. I've got a pi, so what I've got here is actually, oops, when I multiply and divide by, I have an h bar, so I need a c, I'll borrow a c. So I've got an alpha, and then I've got omega cubed divided by c squared. Do you believe all of that? Or you don't really care one way or the other? Mostly you don't care. Okay, so what's an estimate for omega? So omega, when multiplied by h bar, is the energy. And you might remember that the energies of the hydrogen atom were 1/2 mc squared of the electron times alpha squared divided by n squared. So this would be like 1 over n squared 1 minus 1 over n squared 2, right? The difference in energy would be given by h bar omega. And in the context of unit check, we're not caring about things all that accurate. I'm going to have that h bar omega is mc squared alpha squared. Okay, so what have I got? I've got lambda c squared, I've got 1 alpha in the denominator, and now I've got an h bar cubed in order to make this h bar omega, and I've got mc squared alpha squared cubed. Oops, so this is, So I guess, yeah, c squared. I guess I'm happy with that. Okay, well, what are we getting? Okay, so let's deal with the alphas. So we have alpha to the 6th minus 1. We got alpha to the 5th. And we've got 6 factors of C less 2, so we've got 4 factors of C. And let me take my 4 factor of C and just have 1. So then I've got mc cubed, and I've got my h bar cubed. And I have my lambda Compton squared. Okay, so this is just 1 over lambda Compton, so we've got alpha to the 5th c divided by a Compton wavelength. Okay, so the basic time is the time it takes for light to travel a Compton wavelength. And a Compton wavelength is a small fraction of an atom. But then that time is going to be multiplied by 137 cubed. So we've got a really short time that's then being lengthened out. And if you plug and chug through this, what you get is something that's on the order of 10 to the minus 10th seconds. Okay, now we put in the biggest possible value for omega because, I mean, the difference in squares here is not going to give us 1. Typically the times are going to be longer than 10 to the minus 10th seconds, but typical values are going to be in nanoseconds. So these states don't stay excited very long. How could we, is that a reasonable answer? Does that correspond to what we would expect classically? Well, I might remember we looked at the formula for the amount of light that's produced by an accelerated charge. And if we adopt a real simple point of view, if we really think the high school idea of the electron is going around in a circular orbit, we can calculate what the acceleration would be of that guy, and we can plug into the formula for the power that's emitted from a accelerated charge. So that's the power that's emitted. If I take the power times the time, I should get the energy that's lost, right, which is this alpha squared mc squared energy sorts of possibility. And it works out. You get pretty much the same unit by doing that. And it was actually, this is part of the logic into what Bohr called the correspondence principle, that quantum mechanics can't be radically different from Newtonian mechanics. So it must be that something like this is going to be the case. Okay, so lifetimes that are nanoseconds for typical atomic sorts of processes. So this was a so-called allowed process, electric dipole moment, but there are other, I think I've told you that everything is possible kind of if you wait long enough. So there are other slower processes for so-called forbidden transitions. So what are the selection rules for these transitions? Well, in order for this process to work, this electric dipole moment had to not be zero. So roughly speaking, what are the requirements for that thing not to be zero? Okay, so let's think about psi b, and let's start with z. Under what conditions is that going to be non-zero? Well, if you remember, these psis all have e to the I m phis in them, right? And there's no e to the I m phi there. So e to the I, the other m times phi. If m doesn't equal m prime, then I'm going to have zero when I do the integration, right? Because the area under sine and cosine for a complete revolution of phi is zero. So delta m being zero is at least one possibility. How about if we put in x and y here? And the easiest thing to put in is x plus iy. If I put that in here, of course, what I'm going to get is e to the I phi, right? Because I'll get a cosine plus sine. So under these circumstances, if m prime was equal to m plus 1, I would get a transition. And of course, with minus, so I need a change of m that is plus minus 1. So parity. If you send r to minus r, if you do an inversion, what happens to these wave functions? So we've talked about left-right symmetry in one dimension, so kind of the equivalent thing in three dimensions is sending r to minus r in terms of the vector r. What's the parity of these things? Well, it turns out that the parity is just minus to the corresponding L value, so that S waves have positive parity and P waves have negative parity. If the thing's going to integrate to something that's not zero, it has to have even parity overall. And z by itself has odd parity, right? If I send r to minus r, z changes sign. Right? So I have to have that L1 minus L2 is odd. And I can actually do better than that. I can claim that delta L has to be plus or minus 1. That if I actually do these integrals, the only overlap we're going to get is if the psi A and psi B have L's that differ by 1. I could prove that by just doing a lot of ugly integrals. So instead of proving it, I'm going to basically assert it. And what I'm going to tell you is that if we have a y okay, so you can imagine such an integral where I have y1 and y3 and I put in between them a y of L value 2. And one can show that this thing is proportional to the Clebsch-Gordan coefficient that would connect L1 and L2 to L3. And I don't know if it's you remember these YLMs good enough to remember, but you might remember that the first order Legendre polynomial is just cosine theta. And y1, 1 is basically just x plus iy. So this guy here, whether we're talking about x or y or z, all of those are just y's with l equal 1. So if I add l equals 1 to l1, what can I get? Well, I can get everything between the sum and the difference. And the possibility of 0 is outlawed by the parity argument. So I've got to have delta L as plus or minus 1. So if you look at the basic hydrogen spectra, right? So you remember that there's 1s, and there's 2s and 2p, and 3s, 3p, and 3d. We can have a transition like that, because L has changed by 1. And we could have a transition like this, because L has changed by 1. We can have a transition like that or that. Can't have a transition like that. This guy here, there's no place it can go. Right? It can't go to the ground state, because that would require a change in L that is 0. So that state is metastable. It has to decay by one of these special rules, like magnetic dipole moment or electric quadrupole or two photons. We haven't talked about that, but it's also a possibility to emit two photons at once. All of those are much lower probability than the E1, at least for an atom. So that's all for the hydrogen atom. How does this all play out for the more complicated atoms, right? Where we have a total angular momentum S, L, and a total spin angular momentum S, and a total angular momentum J. What are the selection rules for those guys? And all you have to do is use that 3y integral in order to come up with these. Some of these, I hope, are pretty obvious right from the start. The change in the spin has to be 0, because there's nothing spinning here. So if the spin wave function of this guy is different from the spin wave function of that guy, they're going to be orthogonal. There's nothing to mess up that. And generally speaking, these rules are going to look pretty similar to what we have, except with opening up the possibility of 0. But it's a little bit more complicated than that, in that J equals 0 going to J equals 0, that particular change in J of 0 is not allowed. And the reason is maybe kind of clear, and that is that the photon is itself, of course, we don't have photons yet, so this is an argument from quantum field theory. The photon itself has angular momentum 1. It has spin 1. And if we went from 0 to 0, there'd be no angular momentum to give to the photon. So couldn't be. And similarly, L going to 0 is not allowed. Well, I guess I should talk about the change in the total M value. So for the totals, the M value can change by 0. And again, 0 to 0 is not allowed if the change in J is 0. Okay, and I think I've shown you these electric dipole selection rules before. And I guess I still haven't justified them, I've just written them down. But we have shown them, I have shown what they have to be for the hydrogen atom. Questions? Okay, so that's it. The exam will be the four approximation methods we've talked about. I just put a cheat sheet up that so kind of the problem is, in this cheat sheet I put up, you know, the approximation methods are here at the bottom, but we still need to know what these wave functions are. And probably you could delete that. I'm pretty likely to tell you about what the wave functions are. I don't know, I've put what I thought was what was correct. Another thing that's often useful to do integrals, of course, is the raising and lowering operators. So being able to do integrals without doing integrals using raising and lowering operators is a great benefit. So you should expect problems from from those three, right? WKB, Rayleigh-Ritz perturbation theory, time-dependent perturbation theory. And at least in the current form, there's some choice that's involved in selecting problems. We're getting into an overall problem in that a single problem, as you may have noticed in homework, can take more than an hour to work. So it's hard to finish four problems. Questions?
Here's an off-topic question. What's Feynman's claim to fame, since he seems like he's a...
He's God. So as one of the students said, since we're a Catholic university, it can't be God. It's got to be King. So other than telling you that he's a great guy, what can I tell you about him? So I've already told you that he invented Feynman diagrams, which is perturbation theory applied to relativistic field theory. He did lots of, so just like Einstein did lots of things in addition to the things that he was famous for, Feynman did lots of other very deserving things. So Gell-Mann and Zweig, I don't know, circa 1962, kind of invented quarks. I say kind of because they didn't really, their paper makes no hint that quarks actually exist, that they might just be a mathematical necessity. So Feynman was the guy who actually provided a theoretical framework for experimenters to show that quarks actually literally exist. So he called them partons, and because they were part of the neutron and proton, and invented a whole formalism in order to deal with partons, and then eventually experimentally show that partons were the same thing as the quarks that had been kind of hypothesized by Gell-Mann and Zweig. So yeah, I'm not sure I've convinced, I'm sure I haven't convinced you. Obviously he won a Nobel Prize. He actually worked in lots of different fields. So he also has a famous result in condensed matter theory that has to do with superfluidity. So he did lots of things. And he would be, so I mean there's a book titled Genius that summarizes the sort of respect that he's held in. So he would be on the short list of the greatest theorists of the 20th century. I'm not sure whether you would put Einstein there or not is kind of up for grabs. Yeah, I guess you'd put Einstein there. He did some good things. But Feynman did at least that much. So the Nobel Prize is for Feynman diagrams for making renormalization work for quantum field theory, which led the way for everything in particle physics. So Feynman was a theorist who worked, generally speaking, in the area of particle theory.